T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Knight Rider, a shadowy flight.
It's even self-evident, and the Knight Rider theme song begins. I'm told that producer Danny Garcia is in a...
I'm in a theme music
in a TV theme kind of mood. Now, the TV theme has died. Yeah, you know, it's actually something that has been discovered in research, that research killed the TV theme. As I watched the Survivor theme on my television, that is a memorable one. But the TV theme died as a result of TV companies doing focus groups where they said, well, how can we save, you know, time on a show? Well, what if we cut 30 seconds of the theme and added 30 seconds of content? People would be more likely to watch that. I would argue it makes shows more homogenous. And that is kind of what's happened to network television, hasn't it? That every show kind of feels the same.
Yeah, there's no episodic TV anymore. You know, back in the days, you'd have like the intro, it kind of sets you up. Maybe you've never seen the show before.
Yeah.
So it kind of like sets you up to maybe watch the show going forward. But everything is so serialized now, and everything is so Netflix that, like, I noticed one of my favorite new shows that came out on Netflix last year, which they're shooting season 2 now, is a remake of the old 1950s Lost in Space.
Okay.
Now, they have a fantastic intro. Like, I could watch that intro 1,000 mm-hmm. times over.
Yeah.
But they play it in the first episode, and then after that, it's just like, you know, cut right into the show.
Right.
10-second stinger of the title into episode. And you don't see the intro anymore.
And now Netflix even has, you know, for the old shows that they have on there that have the title and all the episodes, it allows you to skip it.
So yes, you have skip intro button.
Yeah, which I use when I watch The West Wing a lot because I'm old and I'm into politics. And so I love watching The West Wing. I basically, since I discovered it's on Netflix, I've basically watched it once a year, which is embarrassing, but I do it anyway. And every episode, and not only that, because then they'll do previously on The West Wing, and it's like a 40-second vignette of what happened, you know, to set up that episode. That's gone too. So that's one of those things. It's a bygone era of television. But Chris Whittingham here until 10 p.m. this evening. Got lots to get to. Want to talk plenty of NBA. Tonight is UNC and Duke. That is a 9 p.m. game. And according to various reporters and anyone who has access to StubHub, tickets for tonight's UNC game at Cameron Indoor Stadium, get in the door, is $2,500. $2,500 to see an amateur sporting event. And I want to get to that later on. Maybe a little bit of Manny Machado as well. And I'm also debating on whether or not I want to yell for 10 minutes about the handball rule in soccer. Because I think it's just... It's reached a point where I don't know what handball is anymore, just as people don't know what a catch is in football. I don't know what handball is, and it's infuriating.
Well, you came in pretty strong with Alex Dono before the second year. I
gave him the furnace blast of the take.
Yeah, I've never heard you use a swear word until tonight.
Really? I feel like I'm a fairly liberal cursor, if it happens to your team, that's when you get mad. I actually find, because I'm on the radio and I analyze all the local teams, I don't really get mad at local sporting events, just as at the same time, I also don't really experience the emotional highs. That actually, oddly enough, died for me with the 2012 NBA Finals when the Heat won their first one of the Big Three era. I was working that whole summer on the radio, and I was producing, and I was thinking about that experience in the prism of content, right? Like, how do we talk about this? What are the angles in which you talk about it? And so you kind of stop experiencing it as an emotional, crazed fan. And so, like, Game 6 in Boston was the last Heat game where, like, I was a nervous wreck beforehand. Where, like, I mean, that day, I remember I worked that morning, and then the entire day, I went back to bed because I was exhausted, and I didn't get up until it was time to go watch the game because I was that emotionally scarred going into that game, because if the Heat lose to Boston on that night, then it's all over and, you know, the sky is falling. But That was really the last time, from a local vantage point, that I really felt like emotional and scared and nervous and angry at the officials and all the things that I feel about the local teams. I still love the local teams and I want them to succeed. And I imagine when Inter Miami starts, I'm going to be, you know, a crazy person about the way that those games go. But I really don't experience things through the emotional prism anymore.
Well, I can totally relate with you because that same championship, I was in this building and I got here at about 5 o'clock. I left. I did my show from 10 to 3, went home for about 2 hours, came back about 4 or 5 o'clock, and I didn't leave this building until 3 o'clock the next day. And it was all about content and getting guys on air. So I really couldn't experience it until I had to work as a reporter, which was actually one of the gravest sins I've ever committed. I was this reporter at the Spurs game where Ray Allen hits the shot.
Yes.
And I was sitting in the section, and I think most of the media had pretty much left and everybody made the line
downstairs. I left.
Yeah, and I was sitting there, and it was just me and Mike Lubitz. and we hit the shot, and then we look around the media section, and we're like, oh, we're the only ones here? Yeah!
And that was actually a horrible experience for me. I, too, was in that media section for Game 6 of the Spurs series, and I was sitting next to these two guys, and I looked at their outlets, and I couldn't tell what they were, and they spent the whole game cheering for the Spurs. Standing up actively, which is the cardinal rule of the press box is no cheering in the press box. That is the fundamental requirement of being in a press area. And I'm like, dude, I would like to cheer too. I'm not because I'm a professional. What are you doing? And he like got mad at me. He was like cursing me out. And I'm going to pull up the box score of that Heat Spurs game because once. Was it Manu Ginobili? What was going to
the free throw
line?
Missed the free throws.
He missed the two free throw lines. But when he got fouled, I said to Chris Cochran, who was working with me from 790 at the time, "All right, we're gone. Let's go." And we walked downstairs, and I went to the bathroom, and I saw George Sedano, now of ESPN, then I think of WQIM.
Yes, he was. A QAM.
I saw him in the bathroom. I'm like, man, this is a bummer. And he goes, no, it's like a 3-point game. And I'm like, what? And so we ran over and we were following the television. And basically, we were waiting for the roar of the crowd to tell us what was going to happen because we have a TV downstairs in the workroom area, and the TV is on the broadcast delay. We don't have a live feed, and so all we hear is we hear this massive swell of noise, and that's how we know that. That the Heat have tied the game and we're going to overtime. And so I'm running out. This is like a crazy scene. And so we're running out and we basically go into the staging area in behind the court. And you can walk out to the court. Obviously, we're not allowed out there. But what we do see is the temporary stage that they build on the court to award the championship. All the pieces had been assembled outside of that entrance. To be ready to be wheeled onto the court so they can put it together and give the Spurs the trophy. And I got to watch as a very enthusiastic building manager shouted, "Put it all back!" And you see this like cavalry of stage pieces and all this being run back to wherever it is they house the thing. And that was my, get the effing ropes out of here. That was my experience of, we're no longer celebrating. Get it all out.
I remember as they were losing that game, I remember the ropes came out around the edge, right?
Yeah.
And I remember Birdman looked at the ropes and looked at the guy with the ropes, and I remember noting in my head that he looked pissed.
Yeah.
So after the game, the guy I go up to is right to Birdman, and I go, Chris, when they pulled the ropes out, what was your thought? And he just put this really aggressive look on his face, and he cocked himself like bicep forward.
Yeah.
And he looks at me and he just goes, "You better pull the rope back, boy." That was my soundbite from Birdman.
Of course it was. But yeah, okay, so the way that whole situation worked, it was 89-89 after Tony Parker made a jumper, then he made another jumper. And then, so that made it 91-89 with 58 seconds left. Manu Ginobili then hit two free throws. So it's a 4-point game. So this is where I left. LeBron James turns the ball over to Manu Ginobili, and Ray Allen fouls him. And so he's going to the line with the Spurs up 4 with 28 seconds left. I'm thinking he hits two. It's a 6-point game. And how are the Heat going to make up a 6-point differential? And then LeBron hits the three. Kawhi Leonard goes 1 of 2 at the free throw line, which that's another one that's sort of fundamental. And then Ray Allen hits the shot. It's the shot to save the Heat season. But yeah, I experienced that basically backstage at American Airlines Arena. I don't know how we got... Oh yeah, so the emotional way with which one experiences sports, rounding it all back. So I'm watching Manchester City today. They're my Premier League team, and they're really the team because I don't cover Manchester City on this radio station, nor do I really. So I still experience those games as a fan, and I'm, you know, muttering at the television like a crazy person because they got screwed today on a penalty decision. They were given two penalties against them in a period of like 6 minutes. And I was furious because a shot came from outside of the penalty area and it struck the arm of a defender for Man City. And I remember during the World Cup, I think it was a Spain game. I want to say either Gerard Piqué or Sergio Ramos was whistled for a penalty. And I'm just so confused as to how a ball can be hit and the defender's arm is like a yard away from him. It hits his arm when he's jumping, and that's a penalty. Like, doesn't make any sense to me. And I went and looked up the rules. The rules say that handball is a deliberate attempt to play the ball. It's not anytime the ball touches your hand, it's a penalty or it's a foul or it's a free kick or whatever. It has to be a deliberate attempt to play the ball. And the guy from Man City is in the process of putting his arm behind his back so that the ball doesn't hit his arm. And in that process, the ball hits his arm, and they give a penalty. And I'm just like, what is the point of having a rule book that says the word deliberate, a deliberate attempt to play the ball with your hand or arm, and then in the process of trying to deliberately not play the ball with your arm, it's given as a penalty. I just did my rant. I mean, it was... Oh, God, what a horrendous decision.
Well, you know what I think it is, Chris, and I've given this a lot of thought over the years when it comes to officials and just sports in general. I think what ends up happening, it's a two-pronged problem of their own mentality. See, you have the rules, and they learn the rules, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then something happens, and they get a call wrong.
Yeah.
But instead of saying to themselves, let me look back at that. I got this wrong. Mm-hmm. Let me learn. They say, oh, no, I got it right. Mm-hmm. So then all of a sudden in their head, the rule becomes mm-hmm. how they got it wrong.
Correct.
And so then now going forward, that's how they call it.
And every subsequent decision is viewed through the lens of, well, that was a handball, so this
is
a handball.
This is a handball, so that's a handball.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a good game of telephone from one up to the other.
Can we look at the rule book? The rule book says deliberate attempt to play the ball. And now, like, anytime the ball touches a player's arm, it's handball. And it's the worst. Anyway, so we're going to get to South Florida sport. I really could rant about this for 2 hours. I actually today typed in the following words into Google. FIFA law book 2018-19. I was looking for a book of laws on soccer today because I was that angry at halftime. And I was going to justify, and I found the rule. I mean, you know what? We're here. I'm going to lean even further into this. The rule book says deliberate attempt to play the ball. I'm gonna find the exact legal language of the handball rule. Oh, hell yeah. This is where we're starting at 8 p.m. Handling the ball involves a deliberate act of a player making contact with a ball with the hand or arm. The following must be considered: the movement of the hand towards the ball, not the ball towards the hand, the distance between the opponent and the ball. The position of the hand does not necessarily mean there is an offense. Ugh, God. And I'm looking at it, I'm going, I mean, come on. We're seriously going to do a penalty decision because a guy is moving his arm out of the way of the ball. And it's like the catch rule. I mean, it's like the block charge rule. It's like all these different rules. It's like 5,000 times it's yes and 5,000 times it's no, but it has no bearing or meaning on an actual legal language. And again, you mentioned problems with this. Another part of it is the legalese with which these rules get written. I mean, what I just read are not real human sentences. No human would ever say, well, this is what handball is. No, it's some lawyer went over and went, well, this is how you have to describe it in order for you to not have any holes in your logic. All right, I'm going to stop talking about handball decisions that happened in Germany today. Coming up next, I want to talk about the NBA, and I want to play some sound for you from Pat Riley reacting to LeBron James leaving the Heat and how he felt immediately and now since. It's from Dan Levitard's new TV show on ESPN that's airing on Sunday. That comes your way next year on WQAM. Radio.com. Radio. 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 Radio.
BigCityRadio.com.
Chris Whittingham here on 560 WQAM. Producer Danny is in a TV theme sort of mood. And so we go for the Addams Family. I thought there would be more obscure where I would...
Oh, I can get really obscure.
Well, I mean, you know.
All right, I'm going to step up my game. All right, cool.
No. I mean, it has to be a slow build. And so I think, you know, we're on the right territory. And we'll see what you have for the rest of the show. So here until 10 p.m. this evening, Alex Dono brought you Fight Night earlier tonight. And so now we'll bring you a two-hour extravaganza until we bring you to Pharrell on the Bench on CBS Sports Radio and right here on 560 WQM. The unmistakable pipes of one Scott Pharrell come your way
Pharrell
at 10 p.m.
How can I be the man? You the man?
I mean, is doing the Pharrell voice just making your voice seem as gravelly as possible?
It's about hurting your vocal cords as much as possible.
I don't know how he does it. I've heard that the voice started as a voice, and then it became his voice. And it seems unpleasant. I mean, I just harmed my larynx doing a two-second impersonation of that. I have a very sensitive larynx because, you know, we talk a lot. And so I don't want to be like, oh, I'm going to screw up my voice doing an impersonation. I mean, when I do my English impersonation, it does not hurt my voice whatsoever.
Well, it's smooth.
Right, exactly. You don't have to yell.
By the way, in the last segment, I really love how you say Premier League. That was great.
I mean, it's the Premier League. I mean, you know what's funny? People make fun of me for that, and yet people would say premiere, like a movie premiere. And
no, you're saying it properly.
But there's no E at the end. There's no E at the end of Premier League.
It's the Premier League.
It's the Premier League. I mean, what are we talking about? Do we have that Pat Riley sound ready to go?
It's entering the system as
it
we speak.
It is entering the system. So Pat Riley was on Dan Le Batard's new TV show, which is called The Art of Conversation. He is going to be doing longer form interviews with various subjects, the first of which is Pat Riley. And so it'll air on, I believe it's Sunday at 5:30 p.m. The show will air. You can set your DVRs now. And so Pat Riley is talking to Dan about a variety of subjects, one of which includes the Big Three Heat and really the aftermath of the LeBron James decision to go back to Cleveland. So he feels, and you'll hear in the clip, that he felt like it was, you know, if he stayed for 10 years, they could have appeared in the championship 8 times. I mean, you think about it, LeBron James ended up going to Cleveland. They didn't really build a team that was that much better than the Miami Heat, and they went to 4 more finals. I mean, imagine if he stays, is it 8 finals in a row for this Heat team? And so what is that alternate timeline? And Pat Riley, as the basketball historian, as this guy that wants to win, it feels like, okay, this is my generational team. This is how I leave. And if he signs another big contract, I can go. And this is my legacy. I mean, imagine being able to leave the NBA with that as your legacy. And now he's kind of looking at, he says elsewhere in the interview where he goes, I don't want to leave until I've built another championship team. I mean, that's a full 5-6 years. I mean, even if it's just built a competitor for a championship team, understanding that the NBA can be cyclical and things can be turned around quickly, especially for a city like Miami, a market like Miami, that has the attraction where Jimmy Butler wanted to come here, even though, I mean, what's here, particularly if you want to win the championship, what's here for you to win? And so the fact that Miami can turn it around, again, yet more evidence as to why those contracts are complete unmitigated disaster that they've signed. But Pat Riley wants to build out another contender because he regrets the fact that LeBron James left. And so he basically says in the clip, and we'll hopefully have it for you soon, that a period of temporary insanity washed over him, that he temporarily went insane, and that he was really angry when LeBron left. And I kind of want to examine the effects of that temporary insanity. How long did it last? How long is basically the genesis of the organization to overcome the effects of LeBron James? You're not going to break me. And I feel like the short-term effects of that, I mean, in some respects, it's like basketball grieving. I mean, you look at what Cleveland became for a period of 4 years before he returned and what they are now. I mean, I don't think they've had a 30-win season since LeBron James left Cleveland the first time and he wasn't on the team. So here are their records for the 4 years after LeBron left. I was wrong, actually. 19-63, 21-45, 24-58, and then they went 1 year with 33 victories. That's their most in a year, and it probably will be again with LeBron James not on the Cavs since 2010. This year they're 12-46. So, I mean, that's on pace. I mean, you win a fifth of your games. That's like a 16-17 win team. And so that's what the Cavs have been. And LeBron James, because of what he brings, the Lakers for me are next. Unless they find young superstars that are willing to stay after he leaves, it really is like removing your central nervous system as a team and having to find a new one. Like, you need heart replacement. It's that bad in terms of what it takes to get him, what it takes to build around him, the mortgaging of the future you have to do, and then building a system and a team that's built to survive without LeBron James. You see teams struggle without LeBron James. I mean, Kyrie Irving has now a team built around him in Boston that's in the upper echelon of the Eastern Conference. They're 37-21. And yet, when LeBron James left games and the offense was built around Kyrie Irving, they couldn't survive. I mean, they couldn't survive 5 minutes on the floor without LeBron James because the whole thing is built around him and his skill set and the specific way in which he excels. The whole thing is built around it. And so in order to recover in the aftermath of that, it takes a lot of structure. And the Heat have obviously done the best job. He's only left two teams, and the Heat are the only ones that have made the playoffs in the aftermath of LeBron leaving. But so the immediate reaction is we're going to sign Chris Bosh to a long-term extension, full max, because we're afraid he's going to go to Houston. And we can't lose both LeBron and Bosh. Then pay a little bit cheaper for Dwayne Wade, and you start to build your team. And then halfway through that first season, you're like, we need a point guard. Why? Because we're going to make the playoffs without LeBron. That was their goal, is in the first year after LeBron leaves, we're going to make the playoffs. And so they trade two first-round picks for Goran Dragic. So that, and you look at, I mean, what two first-round picks gets you now. Like, for Dallas, it's Kristaps Porzingis. Like, that's a game-changer, a franchise-changer, if it works out in the long term, for 10 years. I mean, that's a player that people are calling the unicorn. And so that's what two first-round picks gets you. The Heat did not get enough for their two first-round picks, especially when one is still out there. The Heat are going to have to try and rebuild in 2021 without their first-round pick. And so you're trying to win now. You need that point guard so you can win now, and you have a team with Goran Dragic and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, and you're going to go again in the playoffs. And then as you trade for Goran Dragic, Chris Bosh gets sick, he misses the rest of the year, and you miss the playoffs. In the middle of all that, you're bringing Tyler Johnson in and Hassan Whiteside in. Hassan Whiteside in the second season after LeBron leaves goes on this incredible run, convinces you that, I mean, this guy might be a max player. This guy is a special, special player that you found out of nothing. And more on that in a second. But you start to convince yourself that you're building a strong team in 2015-16. But when they're healthy, when Chris Bosh was healthy in the first half of 2015-16, was not particularly good. They're a few games over. They're trending in the right direction, but not particularly good. Then you get to keep Justice. You have Justice Winslow, you have Josh Richardson, and you go to the playoffs. You get to the second round of the playoffs, and you're thinking, okay, well, let's see what we can do when Chris Bosh comes back. But then Chris Bosh doesn't come back, and you let Dwayne Wade go. I mean, the temporary insanity of being mad at everyone continues with the corrosiveness between Pat Riley and Dwayne Wade. How does that happen? How does that relationship break down? What happened? And I really think, talking about temporary insanity following LeBron James leaving, I think part of that is Pat Riley being mad at Dwayne Wade because Dwayne Wade didn't tell him that LeBron was leaving. That caught him so off guard. And how could you have been on a private plane back from Las Vegas? That's a 5-hour flight. That is a long-ass trip across the country. On the back of the plane, the SI letter is being written. Lee Jenkins is on that plane. And Dwayne Wade doesn't know? How does that happen? And Dwayne Wade swears that he did, and Brian Windhorst has told the story about how that all played out, and that Dwayne Wade was indeed kept out of the loop because LeBron James didn't want to put him in that position. But, I mean, you can also say to Pat, hey, Pat, spent 5 hours and we didn't talk about it. Start planning for the worst. And so I really think, again, we're talking about the emotion of the time. Pat Riley, years from now, can say it's been 5 years, and he can say, I'm fine with it. I understood why he left. I get it. He has said it multiple times, including in this interview with Le Batard. But, again, we're talking about temporary insanity. How long did that last? So in 2016, he lets Dwayne Wade go, and then they're piecing together their team. They sign Hassan Whiteside to a maximum extension. That was their day one priority because they were going to get pipped by the Dallas Mavericks for the signing of Hassan Whiteside. That was their day one priority. Think about how, like, out of whack you must be as an organization when instead of thinking about your first priority being Dwayne Wade, your first priority is, well, should we max Dallas's offer for Hassan Whiteside? Dwayne Wade's first in that equation, if you're really intent on keeping him, if you're intent on building that relationship. But I don't think he was. If you think about it being secondary, think about Pat not being the one to go see him. It was Mickey Arison. Pat Riley was mad at him for a variety of reasons. But I think LeBron James has to be in the top five. And so then you have Whiteside, who again, and this is to me where the Heat's full temporary insanity after LeBron James leaves is complete. You match the Tyler Johnson contract. You sign Hassan Whiteside to a maximum extension, and then you bring in this group of journeymen. And this group of journeymen, James Johnson and Deion Waiters and Wayne Ellington, you piece it together, and you're going to go with this team into 2016-17. You start 11-30. And that feels like rock bottom. Like, holy crap, we have actually failed to build a team without LeBron James, without Dwayne Wade, without Chris Bosh. What the hell are we now? But that team pulls off this miraculous turnaround, goes 30-11, and misses the playoffs by a hair. And this, for me, is where the temporary insanity... For me, the temporary insanity ends this year. Ends with the past trade deadline, where all you get in exchange for your full roster is some salary relief for Tyler Johnson. That's it. That's all they managed to do in a period of a year, basically. You had free agency, you had a trade window in the summer, a trade window before the deadline, and all you've done is get rid of Tyler Johnson for like a few million dollars in cap relief. And that's it. And I think this is the realization, okay, we need to turn things around and change course of our franchise. Because 2017, that summer, signing all those contracts, so the temporary insanity continues with, okay, I mean, and Pat Riley, for me, the ultimate irony is that in the interview, he's wearing a shirt that says culture on it. Heat culture. That's what he most wants to give off because they built something. They built something that takes otherwise average and also ran players and turns them into contributors, whether it's veterans like James Johnson, like Whiteside, like Tyler Johnson, like all the guys they've given money to, and Rodney Magruder, Derrick Jones Jr., even Josh Richardson for me fits that category. 40th pick in the draft? That's not meant to succeed in any capacity. And so they've built out this culture that they, and it's basically them saying, oh no, we have something, we have a structure that exists outside of LeBron James. For the next guy that comes, we've got something that's sustainable that we feel like can carry us into the future. But the problem is that they kind of fell in love with themselves in that culture so much that they've given a bunch of long-term, double-digit million-dollar contracts to guys that don't have talent. And so I think, or don't have enough talent, right? Aren't first, second, third guys. I mean, You're talented. You play in the NBA. You're talented, but don't have enough talent. And so I think this, what's happening now with this Heat team is the end of the temporary insanity where, okay, now they have to go back to, we have to be thinking about the championship and guys that can get you to win the championship. And I'm curious to see if the Heat start figuring out ways to get in that game. What do they have to do to get in that game? And for me, the first, like, you got to get the first guy through the door. I don't know who that is because you don't have cap space. And I think Jimmy Butler, like, as much as people talk about, do you really want to give that guy 5 years? He's going to be 30. He's going to have played a lot of minutes under Tom Thibodeau, which is the worst kind of minutes. He has an injury history, and he seems like he's a bit of a difficult personality. Like, he might just kind of be a jackass, Jimmy Butler. And so, as much as I get those things, I understand them, he's also the first guy that gets you through the door, that's at the All-Star game, that's at the highest level of shoe deals, that's playing in the summer in Los Angeles, that, you know, is friends with all these guys that are going to be able to get you in that room. You have to have the link to the current group of stars. There's nobody on this team that is that guy. Hassan Whiteside is not getting some other NBA star to be like, all right, I'm going there so I can play with him. Richardson and Winslow are not those guys. They don't have that guy on their roster. So in some respects, the first guy is the most important. Almost no matter who it is, as long as that person carries that bit of weight with them. And so it's not Tobias Harris. Maybe it's Kawhi Leonard, but I mean, I don't know what Kawhi Leonard's relationships in. Like, I think this is a relationships-based concept that we're talking about. And the Heat might have taken for granted how much Dwayne Wade being that guy in 2010 and earlier was important for that link to the players. Because Pat Riley, in the late 90s, built a championship contender out of scratch. They came up just short, but they were in those conversations to go and win a championship. But he built that from scratch. I mean, it's from the inherited roster and trade, free agent signing, and they've got a team. And so I think that the Heat now need to kind of examine their model and go, all right, well, obviously, and I think they are. I think what's happening now is pretty sobering. To be at the All-Star break and be out of the playoffs in this crop of Eastern Conference teams highlights, they're pretty far away. And I think Pat Riley's got a chance to go and fix it. But it's got to start with the first guy. And it's not going to be with cap space this summer unless they pull off have some incredible luck and Hassan Whiteside is convinced to opt out because he's restored his free agent value to where maybe he can get $80 million from somebody when he's not going to get that from Miami. And maybe Goran Dragic opts out and next thing you know, you have some money to spend. But I don't know without cap space how this gets fixed. And then you don't really have the draft assets to either trade or turn into players that you then trade. And so I think from a model standpoint, I think they realize that they can't go forward like this. But at the same time, I also don't know how in the near term you can turn the current team into that next iteration. And Pat Riley, if he wants to stay and build another champion, might be 80. He's 73 right now. He's going to be 74 in exactly a month's time. He might be 80 by the time. And so is he just going to do this forever? And is he going to have the cachet the next time he walks in a room? And so I'm fascinated by sort of Pat Riley's, you know, public admission that, you know, there was some temporary insanity. But my question is, how temporary was it? And I think you can kind of look back at their pattern of moves and say, it wasn't really that temporary. It was a few years. And that you, like, the current Heat roster is an emotional reaction to LeBron James leaving in 2014. And that's what LeBron James does. It's aftershocks to an organization that you never recover from. Well, you eventually recover. But the only way that we've seen a team recover from it is him going back. So I'm fascinated now by how Miami can go and fix it and find a new model and go again. All right, coming up next, I want to talk about the Miami Dolphins because another report came out about another player that's probably not coming back. And I think we're on the brink of a purge. That's next year on WQAM.
radio.com. Radio.com.
Sounds like a cop drama.
Very close. This is one of my favorite shows growing up, by the way.
Chris Whittingham here on 560 WQAM. Producer Danny Garcia is trying to stump me. That's a sting that I should know. What is it?
Night Court.
Ah! That's too old for me.
Do one thing to protect the environment.
You let it run so much that a commercial started playing, or is a commercial as part of the song? That's outstanding. All right, so Chris Whittingham here until 10 p.m. this evening. Alex Downo brought you Fight Night earlier on this evening. Tomorrow night, I'll be back on the air as we'll have Florida Panthers hockey. So 6 to 7 p.m., I'll have the bridge show between Hockman and Crowder and the start of the Florida Panthers taking on the Carolina Hurricanes here on 560 WQM, which actually is a big game in the wild card race. So the Florida Panthers trying to mount their usual late season charge. They have 24 games left, 48 points still on the board. They're probably going to need, the way that these teams are going. The annoying thing about the conference breakdown right now is that you compare East to West, and the West right now, the last wild card spot in the NHL is 60 points, Minnesota Wild. Last wild card spot in the East, 69 points in eighth place. 9 points better than Minnesota. So if the Florida Panthers were in the Western Conference, they'd actually be joint level. That was redundant. They'd be level with the Minnesota Wild on points and have a game in hand, two games in hand, actually, if they were in the West. Yet another reason why sports should get rid of conferences. Hashtag ban conferences.
Why do you hate the conferences?
Because they were established.
More specifically, like for the playoffs. I just want
to. I'm just saying. Overall, there's to me no point to have a conference.
So you don't believe in the East-West separation?
No, because it was established at a time in which geography mattered. Right? We have to have teams in the East playing in the West because they got to hop on a coach flight after the game and be there in time, and we want to have teams that are close to each other play more. Like, do the Florida Panthers have any rivalries? And do they have rivalries that would preclude them that wouldn't happen as a result? Like, they play the Tampa Bay Lightning four times. If that's your biggest rival, you play four times. If they played two times, would that make it worse? If the New York Rangers and the Boston Bruins only play twice, would that make that right? If Montreal and Toronto played twice instead of four times, would that make it that much worse? As opposed to maybe playing Vegas one more time? I just don't understand why any team has conference, any league has conference, unless you basically keep them totally separated, like baseball used to do, where like interleague play.
Which, by the way, I'm all in favor of re-separating baseball. The World Series does not mean the same thing that it used to.
Right, because you're seeing that team for the first time. If you get rid of interleague play, first off, you can make it a full round robin, right? So let's say in the NBA, you only play the teams in the Eastern Conference. You can play every team, I don't know, let's say six times? 14 times six. I do some quick math here.
I know that in the NBA that you only play a Western Conference team twice.
Right.
Home and away.
What I'm saying is like if you're going to have conferences, you basically have to make it so that you're only playing in that conference. It's the only point of having a conference. Otherwise, you're basically, it's a random amalgam of games. And at that point, just balance out the schedule and have a single standing. Just one set of standings so that the 16 best teams get in. For me, in hockey, I guess you can understand putting more teams in. Just because playoffs are random. I think in basketball, you look at this Eastern Conference in particular. There are four teams that deserve to make a playoff. I guess you could say Indiana deserves to fight for it. But Brooklyn does not deserve to be in the playoffs. Charlotte does not deserve to be in the playoffs. Detroit does not deserve to be in the playoffs. Miami, Orlando, Washington, then you get into the tanking teams. None of those teams deserve to be playoff teams. You can even have a 4-5 play-in if you want. But I think you can cut the number of playoff teams. But I think especially in the NHL and the NBA where you play so many games, why do you need to have conferences? So that you can even out the schedule, so that so instead of having a 5-game road trip through the West, it's a 6-game road trip through the West, and you like add games incrementally to the schedule. Like, it's already hard to travel across the NBA. What's a little bit harder by completely balancing out the schedules so that you can just have a single standings, and that we wouldn't be talking about the Los Angeles Lakers missing the playoffs or the Sacramento Kings missing the playoffs. They're better than any of the teams in the East, better than Brooklyn, in my opinion, who are 6 right now in the Eastern Conference. Like, what are these constructs for if not to basically... you're basically trying to create an even map of teams to make the playoffs so that different TV markets are still in it. Like, I don't understand the point in the modern era of sporting travel to still have conferences.
Well, I think that this is kind of an old concept, I'll grant it that, but I think it's still relevant today. I think when you're talking about separating from East to West, it's also geographical from the sense of, it's a rival city kind of thing, I don't know how big the rivalry between Utah and Los Angeles would be, mm-hmm. for example. But if the thought process is if you're in the same geographical area, you're going to have kind of a natural city rivalry and you want to play
but
those
you can
teams
still have,
more often.
More often? I mean,
would you really want, let's think of what's a rival team? Would you really want Miami and New York to play each other as often as they play Utah, for example?
I don't think it, as long as those two teams still play a minimum of twice, maybe it's 3 times, but as long as, if it's twice, do you feel like the rivalry goes away?
It's an event and it's one that comes around more often. Do you really want the Yankees and the Red Sox to play less?
Yeah.
For example?
I do, yeah.
Actually, I don't know.
I mean, like, they play 19 times. It's a lot for 2 teams to play. I mean, it's like the schedule, or is it 19? Or I forget what the number
No,
is.
No, it's 19.
Yeah. And so, I just don't think that we need to build out our sporting constructs so that we have this team play this team enough. I mean, if you think about it, the fact that the NBA has divisions, it's even dumber.
The NBA divisions don't make a lot of sense.
You look at Miami, here are the division rivalries for Miami. Charlotte, Orlando, Washington, Atlanta. There's nothing there.
Maybe with Orlando a little bit.
We need to see a 4th Orlando game. Can't sacrifice the 4th Orlando game.
So let me ask you this, Chris.
Sure.
What is your vision of a perfect NBA?
Oh my God. I'm glad you asked. So we ban conferences. So it's a 30 team standings, and we have a 12 team playoff. Yeah, 12 team playoff. And you have 9 play 12 and 10 play 11 in a 3-game series to get in. To play the 1 seed, or the 1 seed and the 2 seed in this equation.
So then, how would you break down the schedule? Would you play every team an even number of times?
Now, my ideal world is that we cut the NBA schedule down from 82 games to 58 games.
Wow!
And you play play every team once home and once away, if you want.
So you'd play every team twice, and then your schedule is done.
Correct. And if you think about it. An NBA team.
See, I'm okay with cutting the baseball schedule because the baseball schedule is just ridiculously too long and it hurts the game, in my opinion. But I think basketball is kind of just right.
Okay, but here's the thing. The NFL has the biggest following because if you want to be a fan, all you have to know is turn on the television Sunday at 1 and you can watch your team or whenever it is that they're playing. It's once a week. You know ahead of time to look at the schedule and go, once this week, I'm going to see my team play. And I think the NBA is a little bit hurt because in an ideal world, you want to have your fans watch every game. Think about what an hour's commitment it is to, let's call an NBA game 2.5 hours. That's 205 hours of your life if you want to watch every game. Just as you say, let's say the average baseball game is 3 hours, 10 minutes. It's an interminable amount. It's like 510 hours of your life. I mean, that's Now I'm gonna have to do math because I don't want to sound ridiculous. But I mean, it's a ludicrous amount of time. I mean, that's the equivalent of 29 days that you're spending watching your baseball team. If it's, you know, 205 hours, it's the equivalent of like 8 or 9 days that you're spent watching your basketball team. That's a lot of time to devote to something. I think every league can afford to cut, and understanding that they won't because of revenue. But I think every league can afford to cut because ultimately the crazy hardcores like us that will sit down and watch them play on a Friday night in Sacramento when a game starts at 10 p.m. and you're watching the game until 12:45 at night, there aren't very many of us. And so I think if you created fewer games where a fan can go, all right, when do they play?
It becomes an event.
Saturday and Wednesday. Right, exactly. It become more like events, more like watching Sunday afternoon football. There's a reason why it's the most popular sport, because it's a once-a-week commitment. We were talking about this on Monday, Omar Kelly and myself, and we're going, yeah, I mean, think about, you know, the commitment that it takes to be an NFL fan. It's not really that much. And so there are just a lot of people that don't listen to this radio station, that don't really know what's going on, but know that the Dolphins are playing Sunday at 1. I'm going to turn on the television, and we'll find out what's going on with the team then. Like, that's their relationship to the Dolphins. And so I think the NBA can afford to be more like that. Now, I'm not saying that it has to be, but I'm just saying that I think if let's say you want to keep an 82-game schedule, you can balance it out to where you play some teams 3 times and some teams twice. I mean, it's not – even if you want, you can have a 29, you know, play every team 3 times, and you sort of mix up every year which teams you're playing home and which teams you're playing away, and you have a 77-game schedule. But, like, I think balancing out the schedule so that – every team has an equal opportunity to basically prove whether it's better than the rest of the league. I mean, you look at, for example, in the Western Conference right now, there are, you know, like the Los Angeles Lakers, for instance, are out. They have a 1-game above 500 record against the East. But let's take Sacramento, for example. Sacramento's a better example. They're 16-21 against the West. They're 5 games under 500. They're 3 games over 500 as a team because they're 14-6 against the East. If they played an Eastern Conference schedule, they would be the 6th seed in the East, and maybe even in the area of Indiana, because they're that good against the Eastern Conference. And so what if instead of it's imbalanced because of how many times you're playing against the West, you played the Eastern Conference an equal number of times, and we get to really figure out who the 16 best teams are or who the 12 best teams are, however it is you want to format this thing, because I think that's the most fair way to hold a sporting competition. And that for me is what this is that ultimately, we make decisions on how to run a sports competition that are not based on competition, right? They're based on travel and TV and all these other things that have nothing to do with the competition itself. And that's the thing that kind of most drives me crazy about really the broader culture in this country. I say this as if I'm a foreigner, right? I mean, I like English soccer. You play every team twice, home and away. You can spend as much money as you want on your team. And if you lose too much, you exit the league. You get relegated. Like, that's a sporting competition. That's on the merits of sports. There's no question, well, if Man City had just played Man United a couple more times, every team plays the same schedule. We know who the best team is.
But by that logic, then there wouldn't be an Arizona Cardinals, for example, in football, because they would have lost so much over the
of
last
course.
3 decades.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that they would have been relegated. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a merit-based system. Everything is about merit and what you do on the court. And the artificial, you know, heightening of salaries and all this stuff is meant to create an equal playing field and almost has no relation to a sporting competition of who's actually the best. And that, for me, is the ultimate thing with all this stuff. Everything that we talk about is how do you create the best team? How do we judge and analyze the best? I mean, college football has struggled with this for decades. How do you really judge with the best?
Well,
how do you
college
create
football is a whole other conversation, right? I mean, of total unfairness and no competition.
Well, okay, but there's like we talk about what's the ideal world of college football. There is no such thing.
I disagree.
Well, no, because there's 129 teams, and you play a schedule of 12 games. How could you possibly know with certainty who the best of that year is? Obviously, Alabama and Clemson seem to be better than everybody else, but I mean, realistically, in college football, I mean, you could argue for a 64-team playoff. It wouldn't be that out of bounds, in my opinion. Because you have no way of knowing if every team played everybody. But in basketball and in the NBA, we do. In the NHL, we do. In Major League Baseball, we do. The NFL is another one where you have to have a playoff system. You have to kind of increase the playoff field because, again, not everyone can play everybody.
But if you increase the NFL playoff field, then literally half the league would be playing.
No. But like I'm saying now at 12. Like you're fine with it being 12 because you want to give as many teams as possible a chance to play each other in a competitive setting so that we can find out who the best team is. And even then, it's kind of imperfect. The thing behind football is that we really, at the end, don't know who the best team was. I mean, New England won the championship, but do we know that they're the best team? Do you know if they played the Saints in the Super Bowl instead of the Rams, that they would have won the Super Bowl?
But the Saints didn't beat the Rams.
Right, I understood, but...
I know this might be the wrong word, but it seems to me like you're almost arguing about the metaphysics of sports. Well, if this team
right, no.
Team,
but what I'm saying
no,
is,
it was decided on the field.
Understood. But what I'm saying is that in basketball, you have a way of playing everyone multiple times, and you increase the number of that sample. Like the Patriots didn't play all 31 NFL teams last year; they played their schedule, and so we don't really, in a round robin way, know who the best team is. Again, we name a team at the end, and it, by the system, that was the best team. We really don't know if the Patriots played in the NFC, what their one-loss record would have been like, or in which division, you know, like what, like we don't know because that's not that they didn't have the opportunity to play everyone. Whereas in basketball and baseball and hockey, it's such a large sample sport that you can.
Well, yeah. I mean, from that sense, do the Patriots play every team? No. No team plays every team because, again, but then you would get away from what makes football special, which is the fact that you would have to increase the number of games
right, exactly.
for everybody to play, and it's already playing a number of games that would kill them physically. Yep. Let me ask you this. If I was to tell you that the NBA season started at Christmas on Christmas Day,
yeah,
and baseball season ended week one of the NFL season because let's be honest with ourselves. The month of September for baseball is the absolute worst. If you're in it, you're in it. If not, you're calling up whatever minor league guy and you're playing out the string and everybody's dead over there. If you're gonna fight football, at least put your best foot forward if
agreed.
You're baseball.
No, agreed. I mean, I think I wish there was a way that we can all we'd have a meeting where all the leagues got together. All right, what's the best calendar that we can work out so that for me, I think the league that should take advantage of this is hockey. I have long argued that hockey should start their season 2 months later than they do, and they finish the season in August. Imagine if the latter rounds of the hockey playoffs were in August when nothing was going on, right? And they weren't up against the NBA every night. Now that would help them in this country. It wouldn't help them in Canada, right? I mean, in Canada, where they make the bulk of their TV money. But I mean, think about the growth property that the NHL could be if they played in months in which their playoff games every night, I mean, literally night for night, round for round, is level with the NBA. So that was a bit of fixing sports. Coming up next, I mentioned wanting to talk about the purge of the Dolphins. We'll get to it here on QAM.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.